It was Bine, after all, who had introduced her to Theremin one day at the faculty club many months before. Apparently, the newspaper man and the young astronomer had known each other a long time, and Theremin regularly consulted Bine on scientific matters that were making news. What was making news just then was the prediction of Mondior 71 that the world would end on Theptar 19th, which at that time was something close to a year in the future. Of course, nobody at the university held Mondior and his apostles in any sort of regard. But it was just about at the same moment that Bine had come up with his observations of the apparent irregularities in Kalgash's orbit, and Zephyra had reported her findings of fires at 2,000-year intervals at the Hill of Thombo. Both of which discoveries, of course, had the dismaying quality of reinforcing the plausibility of the apostles' beliefs. Theremin had seemed to know all about Sephira's work at Thombo. When the newspaper man entered the faculty club, Sephira and Bine were already there, though not by any prearranged appointment. Bine merely had to say, "Theremin, this is my friend Dr. Sephira of the archaeology department." And Theremin replied instantly, "Oh yes, the burned villages piled up on that ancient hill." Sephira smiled coolly. "You've heard of that, have you?" Bine said quickly. "I told him. I know I promised not to say a word about it to him, but after you revealed everything to Aethor and Sheeran and the rest, I figured it wouldn't matter anymore if I let him know, so long as I swore him to secrecy. I mean, Sephira, I trust this man, I really do, and I was absolutely confident that..." "It's all right, Bine," Sephira said, making an effort not to seem as annoyed as in fact she was. "You really shouldn't have said anything, but I forgive you." Theremin said, "No harm's been done. Bine swore me to a terrible oath that I wouldn't print anything about it. But it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. How old is the one at the bottom, would you say? 50,000 years, is it?" "More like 14 or 16, Sephira said, "which is quite immensely old enough. When you consider that Beklemont, you know of Beklemont, don't you? Is only about 20 centuries old. And we used to think that was the earliest settlement on Kalgash." "You aren't planning to write a story about my discoveries, are you?" "I wasn't, actually. I told you I gave Bine my word. Besides, it seemed a little abstract for the Chronicles readers, a little remote from their daily concerns. But I think now there's a real story there. If you'd be willing to meet with me and give me the details..." "I'd rather not," Sephira said quickly. "Which, meet with me or give me the details?" His quick flip reply suddenly cast the entire conversation in a new light for her. She saw to her mild annoyance and slight surprise that the newspaper man was in fact attracted to her. She realized now, thinking back over the past few minutes, that Theremin must have been wondering all the while whether there might be something romantic going on between her and Bine, since he had found them sitting here in the club together, and had decided at last that there wasn't, so had chosen to offer that first lightly flirtatious line. Well, that was his problem, Sephira thought. She said in a deliberately neutral way, "I haven't published my Thombo work in the scientific journals yet. It would be best if nothing about it gets into the public press until I have." "I quite understand that, but if I promise that I'll abide by your release date, would you be willing to go over your material with me ahead of time?" "Well..." She looked at Bine. What was a newspaper man's promise worth, anyway? Bine said, "You can trust Theremin. I've told you already. He's as honorable as they get in his line of work." "Which isn't saying much," Theremin put in, laughing, "but I know better than to break my word on an issue of scientific publication priority. If I jumped the gun on your story, Bine here would see that my name was mud all over the university. And I depend on my university contacts for some of my most interesting stories. So, can I count on an interview with you? Say, the day after next." And that was how it began. Theremin was very persuasive. She agreed finally to have lunch with him, and slowly, cunningly, he pried the details of the Thombo dig out of her. Afterward, she regretted it. She expected to see a stupid, sensational piece in the Chronicle the very next day. But Theremin kept his word and published nothing about her. He did ask to see her laboratory, though. Again, she yielded, and he inspected the charts, the photographs, the ash samples. He asked some intelligent questions. "You aren't going to write me up, are you?" she asked nervously, "now that you've seen all this?" "I promised that I wouldn't. I meant it. Although the moment you tell me that you've arranged to publish your findings in one of the scientific journals, I'll regard myself as free to tell the whole thing. What would you say to dinner at the Six Suns Club tomorrow evening? Well, or the evening after that? Sapphira rarely went to places like the Six Suns. She hated to give anyone the false impression that she was interested in getting into social entanglements. But Theramin wasn't easy to turn down. Gently, cheerfully, skillfully, he maneuvered her into a position where she couldn't avoid a date with him, for 10 days hence. Well, what of it, she thought. He was personable enough. She could use a change of pace from the steady grind of her work. She met him at the Six Suns, where everyone seemed to know him. They had drinks, dinner, a fine wine from the Fabian province. He moved the conversation this way and that, very adroitly. A little bit about her life, her fascination with archaeology, her excavations at Baclamat. He found out that she'd never been married and had never been interested in marrying. He spoke of the apostles with her, their wild prophecies, the surprising relationship of her Thambo finds to Mondior's claims. Everything he said was tactful, perceptive, interesting. He was very charming, and also very manipulative, she thought. At the end of the evening, he asked her, gently, cheerfully, skillfully, if he could accompany her home. But she drew the line at that. He didn't seem troubled. He simply asked her out again. They had gone out 2 or 3 times altogether after that, over a period of perhaps 2 months. The format was the same each time. Dinner at some elegant place, well-managed conversation, ultimately a delicately constructed invitation for her to spend the sleep period with him. Sapphira deflected him just as delicately each time. It was becoming a pleasant game, this light-hearted pursuit. She wondered how long it would go on. She still had no particular wish to go to bed with him, but the odd thing was that she had no particular wish any longer not to go to bed with him either. It was a long time since she had felt that way about any man. Then came the first of the series of columns in which he denounced the observatory theories, questioned Athor's sanity, compared the scientist's prediction of the eclipse to the mad ravings of the apostles of flame. Sapphira didn't believe it at first. Was this some sort of joke? Binet's friend? Her friend now, for that matter, attacking them so viciously? A couple of months went by. The attacks continued. She didn't hear from Theramin. Finally, she couldn't remain silent any longer. She called him at the newspaper office. Sapphira, what a delight! Believe it or not, I was going to call you later this afternoon to ask if you'd be interested in going to... I wouldn't, she said. Theramin, what are you doing?
Doing?
These columns about Athor and the observatory. There was silence at the other end of the line for a long while. Then he said,
You're upset.
Upset? I'm livid.
You think I've been a little too harsh. Look, Sapphira, when you write for a large audience of ordinary folks, some of them very ordinary, you've got to put things in black and white terms, or run the risk of being misunderstood. I can't simply say that I think Athor and Binet are wrong. I've got to say that they're nuts. Do you follow me?
Since when do you think they're wrong? Does Binet know how you feel?
Well...
You've been covering the story for months. Now you've turned around 180 degrees. To listen to you, one would think that everyone at the campus is a disciple of Mondior and that we're all out of our minds besides. If you needed to find somebody to be the butt of your jokes, couldn't you have looked somewhere else than the university?
These aren't just jokes, Sapphira, Theramin said quietly.
You believe what you're writing?
I do. I honestly do. There isn't going to be any cataclysm, that's what I think. And here's Athor, pulling on the fire alarm in a crowded theater. By my jokes, my poking a little good-natured fun here and there, I'm trying to tell people that they don't necessarily have to take him seriously. Not to panic, not to get into an uproar.
What? She cried. But there is going to be a fire, Theramin, and you're playing a dangerous game with everyone's welfare by your mockery. Listen to me. I've seen the ashes of past fires, fires thousands of years old. I know what's going to happen. The flames will come. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. You've seen the evidence, too, and for you to take the position that you're taking now is the most destructive imaginable thing you could do, Theramin. It's cruel and foolish and hateful and utterly irresponsible.
Sapphira,
I thought you were an intelligent man. I see now that you're exactly like all the rest of them out there.
Sapphira,
she broke the contact and kept it broken, refusing to return any of his calls until just a few weeks before the fateful day itself. Early in the month of Theptar, Theramin called once more,
and Zafira found herself on the line with him before she knew who it was. "Don't hang up," he said quickly. "Just give me a minute." "I'd rather not." "Listen, Zafira, you can hate me all you like, but I want you to know this. I'm not cruel, and I'm not foolish."
"Whoever said you were?"
"You did, months ago, the last time we spoke. But it isn't so. Everything I've written in my column about the eclipse has been there because I believe it."
"Then you are foolish, or stupid at any rate, which may be slightly different, but not any better.
I've looked at the evidence. I think you people have been jumping to conclusions."
She said coldly, "Well, we'll all know whether that's so on the 19th, won't we?"
"I wish I could believe you, because you and Bina and the rest of you are all such fine people, so obviously dedicated and brilliant and all, but I can't. I'm a skeptic by nature. I have been all my life. I can't accept any kind of dogma that other people want to sell me. It's a serious flaw in my character, I suppose. It makes me seem frivolous. Well, maybe I am frivolous, but at least I'm honest. I simply don't think there'll be an eclipse or madness or fires."
"It's no dogma, Theremin. It's a hypothesis."
"Oh, that's playing with words. I'm sorry if what I've written has offended you, but I can't help it, Zafira."
She was quiet a moment. Something in his voice had oddly moved her. She said at last, "Dogma, hypothesis, whatever it is, it's going to be tested in a few weeks. I'll be at the observatory on the evening of the 19th. You come there, too, and we'll see which one of us is right."
"But hasn't Bina told you? Athor's declared me persona non grata at the observatory."
"Has that ever stopped you?"
"He refuses even to talk to me. You know, I have a proposal for him, something that could be of great help to him after the 19th, when all this tremendous buildup misfires into whopping anticlimax and the world comes yelling for his skin. But Bina says there's no chance he'll talk to me at all, let alone allow me to come in that evening."
"Come as my guest, my date," she said acidly. "Athor'll be too busy to care. I want you to be in the room when the sky turns black and the fires start. I want to see the look on your face. I want to see if you're as experienced at apologizing as you are at seduction, Theremin."
22. That had been 3 weeks ago. Fleeing angrily from Theremin now, Zafira rushed to the far side of the room and caught sight of Athor, standing by himself looking through a set of computer printouts. He was sadly turning the pages over and over and over, as though he hoped to find a reprieve for the world buried somewhere in the dense columns. Then he looked up and saw her. Color came to her face.
"Dr. Athor, I feel I ought to ask your pardon for inviting that man to be here this evening, after all he's said about us, about you, about..."
She shook her head.
"I genuinely thought it would be instructive for him to be among us when... Well, I was wrong. He's even more shallow and foolish than I imagined. I never should have told him to come."
Wanly, Athor said,
"It scarcely is of any importance now, is it? So long as he keeps out of my way, I hardly care whether he's here or not. A few more hours, and then nothing will make any difference."
He pointed through the window toward the sky.
"So dark. So very dark. And yet not nearly as dark as it will be. I wonder where Faro and Emot are. You haven't seen them, have you?" "No." "When you came in, Dr. Zafira, you said there'd been a last-minute problem at your office. Not a serious one, I hope."
"The Thambo tablets have disappeared," she said.
"Disappeared?"
"They were in the artifact safe, of course. Just before I left to come over here, Dr. Mudrin came to see me. He was on his way to the sanctuary, but he wanted to check one last thing in his translation, one new notion he'd had. So we opened the safe and... nothing. Gone, all six of them. We have copies, naturally, but still, the originals... the authentic ancient objects."
"How can this have happened?"
Athor asked.
Bitterly, Zafira said,
"Isn't it obvious? The apostles have stolen them, probably to use as some kind of holy talismans after the darkness has come and done its work."
"Are there any clues?"
"I'm no detective, Dr. Athor. There's no evidence that would mean anything to me. But it had to be the apostles. They've wanted them ever since they knew I had them. Oh, I wish I'd never said a word about them to them. I wish I'd never mentioned those tablets to anyone. Aethor took her by the hands.
You mustn't get so upset, my girl.
My girl? She glared at him astonished. No one had called her that in 25 years. But she choked back her anger. He was old, after all, and only trying to be kind. He said,
Let them have them, Sephira. It makes no difference now. Thanks to that man over there, nothing makes any difference, does it?
She shrugged. I still hate the thought that some thief in an apostle's robe was sniffing around in my office, jimmying my safe, taking things that I had uncovered with my own hands. It's like a violation of my body, almost. Can you understand that, Dr. Aethor? To have been robbed of those tablets, it's almost like a rape.
I know how upset you are,
Aethor said in a tone that indicated he didn't really understand at all.
Look. Look there. How bright Dovim is this evening. And in just a little while, how dark everything will be.
She managed a vague smile and turned away from him. All about her, people were buzzing to and fro, checking this, discussing that, running to the window, pointing, murmuring. Now and then, someone would come rushing in with some new data from the telescope dome. She felt like a complete outsider among these astronomers, and altogether bleak, altogether hopeless. Some of Aethor's fatalism must have rubbed off on me, she thought. He seemed so depressed, so lost. It wasn't at all like him to be that way. She wanted to remind him that it wasn't the world that would end this evening. It was just the present cycle of civilization. They would rebuild. Those who had gone into hiding would come forth and start everything over, as had happened a dozen times before, or 20, or 100, since the beginning of civilization on Kalgash. But for her to tell Aethor that would probably do no more good than for him to have told her not to worry about the loss of the tablets. He had hoped all the world would prepare itself against the catastrophe, and instead, only a small fraction had paid any heed to the warning. Just those few who had gone to the university sanctuary, and whatever other sanctuaries might have been set up elsewhere. Binet came over to her. What's this I hear from Aethor? The tablets are gone? Gone, yes, stolen. I knew I never should have allowed myself to have any sort of contact with the apostles, Binet said. You think they stole them? I'm sure of it, she said bitterly. They sent word to me after the existence of the Thambo tablets first became a matter of public knowledge that they had information that would be of use to me. Didn't I tell you? I guess not. What they wanted was a deal similar to the one Aethor worked out with that high priest or whatever he is of Phalaemon 66. We have maintained a knowledge of the old language, Phalaemon said, the language spoken in the previous year of godliness. And so they had, apparently, texts of some sort, dictionaries, alphabets of the old script, perhaps a lot more. Which Aethor was able to obtain from them? Some of it, enough at any rate to determine that the apostles did have genuine astronomical records of the previous eclipse. Enough, Aethor said, to prove that the world had been through such a cataclysm at least once before. Aethor, she went on to tell Binet, had given her copies of the few astronomical text fragments he had received from Phalaemon, and she had shown them to Mudrin, who indeed had found them valuable in his own translation of the tablets. But Sephira had balked at sharing her tablets with the apostles, at least not on their terms. The apostles claimed to be in possession of a key to the early clay tablet script, and perhaps they were. Phalaemon had insisted, though, that she give him the actual tablets to be copied and translated, rather than his giving her the decoding material that he had. He wouldn't settle for copies of the tablet texts. It had to be the original artifacts, or else no deal. But you drew the line at that, Binet said. Absolutely. The tablets mustn't leave the university. Give us the textual key, I said to Phalaemon, and we'll provide you with copies of the tablet texts. Then we can each attempt a translation. But Phalaemon had refused. Copies of the text were of no use to him, since they could all too easily be dismissed as forgeries. As for giving her his own documents, no, absolutely not. What he had, he said, was sacred material, which could only be made available to apostles. Give him the tablets, and he would provide translations of them for her. But no outsider was going to get a look at the texts already in his possession. I was actually tempted to join the apostles for a moment, Sapphira said, just for the sake of getting access to the key.
You? An apostle?
Only to get their textual material. But the idea repelled me. I turned Philemon down.
And Mudrin had to toil on at his translations without the help of whatever material the apostles might have. It became apparent that the tablets did indeed seem to talk about some fiery doom that the gods had set upon the world, but Mudrin's translations were sketchy, hesitant, sparse. Well, now the apostles had the tablets anyway, more likely than not. That was hard to take. In the chaos ahead, they'd be waving those tablets around, her tablets, as still more evidence of their own wisdom and holiness.
I'm sorry that your tablets are gone, Sapphira, Bine said. But maybe there's still a chance the apostles didn't steal them, that they'll turn up somewhere.
I'm not counting on that, said Sapphira, and she smiled ruefully and turned away to stare at the darkening sky. The best she could do by way of comfort was take Athor's line, that the world was ending in a little while anyway, and nothing mattered very much. But that was cold comfort indeed. She fought inwardly against any such counsel of despair. The important thing was to keep on thinking of the day after tomorrow, of survival, of rebuilding, of the struggle and its fulfillment. It was no good to fall into despondency like Athor, to accept the downfall of humanity, to shrug and give up all hope. A high tenor voice cut suddenly across her gloomy meditations.
Hello, everybody!
Hello, hello, hello!
Shirin, Bine cried, what are you doing here?
The plump cheeks of the newcomer expanded in a pleased smile.
What's this morgue-like atmosphere in here? No one's losing their nerve, I hope.
Athor started in consternation and said peevishly,
Yes, what are you doing here, Shirin? I thought you were going to stay behind in the sanctuary.
Shirin laughed and dropped his tubby figure into a chair.
Sanctuary be damned. The place bored me. I want to be here where things are getting hot. Don't you suppose I have my share of curiosity?
I rode in the Tunnel of Mystery, after all. I can survive another dose of darkness, and I want to see these stars that the apostles have been spouting about. He rubbed his hands and added in a soberer tone,
It's freezing outside. The wind's enough to hang icicles on your nose. Dovim doesn't seem to give any heat at all, at the distance it is this evening.
The white-haired director ground his teeth in sudden exasperation.
Why do you go out of your way to do a crazy thing like this, Shirin? What kind of good can you be around here?
What kind of good am I around there?
Shirin spread his palms in comical resignation.
A psychologist isn't worth a damn in the sanctuary. Not now. Not a thing I could do for them. They're all snug and safe, laced and underground. Nothing to worry about.
And if a mob should break in during the darkness?
Shirin laughed.
I very much doubt that anyone who didn't know where the entrance was would be able to find the sanctuary in broad daylight, let alone once the suns have gone out. But if they do, well, they'd need men of action to defend them. Me? I'm 100 pounds too heavy for that. So why should I huddle in down there with them? I'd rather be here.
Sapphira felt her own spirits rise as she heard Shirin's words. She, too, had chosen to spend the evening of darkness at the observatory rather than in the sanctuary. Perhaps it was mere wild bravado. Perhaps it was idiotic overconfidence. But she was sure that she could last out the hours of the eclipse, and even the coming of the stars, if there was anything to that part of the myth, and retain her sanity. And so she had decided not to pass up the experience. Now it appeared that Shirin, no model of bravery, had taken the same approach, which might mean that he had decided the impact of darkness would not be so overwhelming after all, despite the grim predictions he had been making for months. She had heard his tales of the Tunnel of Mystery, and the havoc it had wreaked even on Shirin himself. Yet here he was. He must have come to believe that people, some at least, would turn out ultimately to be more resilient than he had earlier expected. Or else he was simply being reckless. Perhaps he preferred to lose his mind in one quick burst this evening, Sapphira thought, rather than to stay sane and have to cope with the innumerable and perhaps insuperable problems of the hard times ahead. Now she was falling into morbid pessimism again. She brushed the thought away.
Shirin!
It was Theramon coming across the room to greet the psychologist.
You remember me, Theramon 762?
Of course I do, Theramon,
Shirin said. He offered his hand.
Gods, fellow, you've been rough on us lately, haven't you? But bygones may as well be bygones this evening.
I wish he was a bygone, Sephira muttered under her breath. She scowled in distaste and stepped back a few paces. Theramon shook Sheeran's hand.
What's this sanctuary you're supposed to have been in? I heard a little about it here this evening, but I don't have any real idea of what it is.
Well, Sheeran said, we have managed to convince a few people, at least, of the validity of our prophecy of, doom, to be spectacular about it, and those few have taken proper measures. They consist mainly of the immediate members of the families of the observatory staff, certain of the faculty of Sorrow University, and a few outsiders. My companion, Lilith 221, is there at this very moment, as a matter of fact, and I suppose I should be too, but for my infernal curiosity. There are about 300 people, all told.
I see. They're supposed to hide where the darkness and the stars can't get at them, and then hold out when the rest of the world goes poof.
Exactly. The apostles have some sort of hideout of their own also, you know. We aren't sure how many people are in it. Just a few, if we're lucky, but more likely they've got thousands stashed away who will come forth and inherit the world after the darkness.
So the university group, Theramon said, is intended as a counterforce to that?
Sheeran nodded. If possible, it won't be easy. With almost all of mankind insane, with the great cities going up in flames, with perhaps a big horde of apostles imposing their kind of order on what's left of the world, no, it'll be tough for them to survive. But at least they have food, water, shelter, weapons.
They've got more, said Athor. They've got all our records, except for what we will collect today. Those records will mean everything to the next cycle, and that's what must survive. The rest can go hang.
Theramon whistled a long, low whistle.
You people are completely certain, then, that everything you've predicted is going to come about just as you say.
What other position could we possibly take? Sephira asked harshly. Once we saw that disaster would inevitably come...
Yes, the newspaper man said. You had to make preparations for it, because you were in possession of the truth, just as the Apostles of Flame are in possession of the truth. I wish I could be half so certain about anything as all you truth-possessors are about this evening.
She glowered at him. I wish you could be out there this evening, wandering through the burning streets. But no, no, you'll be safe in here. It's more than you deserve.
Easy, Sheeran said. He took Theramon by the arm. Quietly, he said,
no sense in provoking people now, friend. Let's go somewhere where we won't bother people and we can talk.
Good idea, Theramon said. But he made no motion toward leaving the room. A game of stochastic chess had begun around the table, and Theramon stood watching for a moment or two in obvious incomprehension as moves were made rapidly and in silence. He seemed amazed by the ability of the players to concentrate on a game when they all must believe that the end of the world was just hours away.
Come, Sheeran said again.
Yes, yes, said Theramon.
He and Sheeran went out into the hall, followed an instant later by Bine. What an infuriating man, Sephira thought. She stared at the bright orb of Dovim, burning fiercely in the sky. Had the sky grown even darker in the past few minutes? No, no, she told herself, that was impossible. Dovim was still there. It was just imagination. The sky looked strange, now that Dovim was the only sun aloft. She had never seen it like that before, such a deep purple hue. But it was far from dark out there. Somber, yes, but there was light enough, and everything was still easily visible outside, despite the relative dimness of the one small sun. She thought about her lost tablets again. Then she banished them from her mind. The chess players had the right idea, she told herself. Sit down and relax, if you can. 23. Sheeran led the way into the next room. There were softer chairs in there, and thick red curtains on the windows, and a maroon carpet on the floor. With the strange brick-toned light of Dovim pouring in, the general effect was one of dried blood everywhere. He had been surprised to see Theramon at the observatory this evening, after the horrendous columns he had written, after all he had done to pour cold water on Athor's campaign for national preparedness. In recent weeks, Athor had gone almost berserk with rage every time Theramon's name was mentioned. Yet, somehow, he had relented and permitted him to be here for the eclipse. That was odd and a little troublesome. It might mean that the stern fabric of the old astronomer's personality had begun to break down.
that not only his anger, but also his whole inner structure of character was giving way in the face of the oncoming catastrophe. For that matter, Sheeran was more than slightly surprised to find himself at the observatory, too. It had been a last-minute decision, a pure impulse of the kind he rarely experienced. Lilith had been horrified. He was pretty horrified himself. He had not forgotten the terrors that his few minutes in the tunnel of mystery had evoked in him. But he had realized in the end that he had to be here, just as he had had to take that ride in the tunnel. To everyone else, he might be nothing more than an easygoing, overweight academic hack, but to himself, he was still a scientist beneath all the blubber. The study of darkness had concerned him through all his professional career. How, then, could he ever live with himself afterward, knowing that during the most celebrated episode of darkness in more than 2,000 years, he had chosen to hide himself away in the cozy safety of an underground chamber? No, he had to be here, witnessing the eclipse, feeling the darkness take possession of the world. Theremin said with unexpected frankness as they entered the adjoining room, "I'm starting to wonder whether I was right to have been such a skeptic, Sheeran." "You ought to wonder about it." "Well, I am. Seeing just Dovim up there like that, that weird red color spreading over everything. You know, I'd give 10 credits for a decent dose of white light right now. A good stiff Tano special. For that matter, I'd like to see Tano and Setha in the sky, too. Or even better, Onos." "Onos will be there in the morning," put in Binet, who had just entered the room. "Yes, but will we?" asked Sheeran, and grinned immediately to take the sting from his words. To Binet, he said, "Our journalistic friend is eager for a little nip of alcohol. Aetho will have a fit. He's given orders for everybody to be sober here this evening." Sheeran said, "So there's nothing but water to be had?" "Well, come on, Binet. Aetho won't come in here." "I suppose." Tiptoeing to the nearest window, Binet squatted and from the low window box beneath it, withdrew a bottle of red liquid that gurgled suggestively when he shook it. "I thought Aethor didn't know about this," he remarked as he trotted back to the table. "Here, we've only got one glass, so as the guest, you can have it, Theremin. Sheeran and I can drink from the bottle." And he filled the tiny cup with judicious care. Laughing, Theremin said, "You never touched alcohol at all when we first met, Binet." "Well, that was then. This is now. Tense times, Theremin. I'm learning. A good drink can be very relaxing at times like these." "So I've heard," Theremin said lightly. He took a sip. It was some sort of red wine, rough and raw, probably cheap jug wine from one of the southern provinces. Just the sort of thing that a lifelong abstainer like Binet would tend to buy, not knowing any better. But it was better than nothing. Binet helped himself to a hearty gulp and passed the bottle to Sheeran. The psychologist upended it and held it to his lips for a long, slow drink. Then, putting it down with a satisfied grunt and a smack of his lips, he said to Binet, "Aethor seems strange this evening. I mean, even allowing for the special circumstances. What's wrong?"
"Worrying about Faro and Imad, I suppose."
"Who?"
"A couple of young graduate students. They were due several hours ago and haven't shown up yet. Aethor's terrifically short-handed, of course, because all but the really essential people have gone to the sanctuary."
Theremin said, "You don't think they deserted, do you?"
"Who, Faro and Imad? Of course not. They're not the type. They'd give everything to be here this evening, taking measurements when the eclipse happens. But what if there's some kind of riot going on in Saro City and they've been caught in it?"
Binet shrugged. "Well, they'll show up sooner or later, I imagine. But if they're not here as we approach the critical phase, things could get a little sticky when the work piles up. That must be what Aethor's worrying about."
Sheeran said, "I'm not so sure. Two missing men would be on his mind, yes, but there's something else. He looks so old suddenly, weary, defeated even. The last time I saw him, he was full of fight, full of talk about the reconstruction of society after the eclipse. The real Aethor, the Iron Man. Now all I see is a sad, tired, pathetic old wreck who's simply waiting for the end to come. The fact that he didn't even bother to throw Theremin out."
"He tried," Theremin said. "Binet talked him out of it, and Sephira."
"There you are, Binet. Did you ever know anyone who was able to talk Aethor out of anything? Here, pass me the wine."
"It may be my fault," Theremin said. "Everything that I wrote, attacking his plan to set up sanctuary-type shelters all across the country,
If he genuinely believes that there's going to be a worldwide darkness in a few hours and that all mankind will go violently insane, which he does, said Binet, as all of us do, then the failure of the government to take Athor's prediction seriously must be an overwhelming, crushing defeat for him. And I'm responsible as much as anyone. If it turns out that you people were right, I'll never forgive myself. Sheeran said,
Don't flatter yourself, Theremin. Even if you had written 5 columns a day calling for a colossal preparedness movement, the government still wouldn't have done anything. It might have taken Athor's warnings even less seriously than it did, if that's possible, with a popular crusading journalist like you on Athor's side.
Thanks, Theremin said. I really appreciate that. Is there any wine left? He looked toward Binet. And of course I'm in trouble with Sephira, too. She thinks I'm too contemptible for words.
There was a time when she seemed really interested in you, Binet said. I was wondering about it for a while, as a matter of fact, whether you and she were...
No, Theremin said, grinning. Not quite. And we never will now, but we were very good friends for a while. A fascinating, fascinating woman. What about this cyclic theory of prehistory of hers? Is there anything to it?
Not if you listen to some of the other people in her department, Sheeran said. They're really scornful of it. Of course, they've all got a vested interest in the established archaeological framework, which says that Baklamat was the first urban center, and that if you go back more than a couple of thousand years, you can't find any civilization at all. Just primitive, shaggy, jungle-dwelling folk.
Well, but how can they argue away these recurrent catastrophes at the Hill of Thombo? Theremin asked.
Scientists who think they know the real story can argue away anything that threatens their beliefs, Sheeran said. You scratch an entrenched academic, and you'll find he's pretty similar in some ways to an apostle of flame underneath. It's just a different kind of robe they wear.
He took the bottle which Theremin had been idly holding and helped himself again.
The deuce with them. Even a layman like me can see that Sephira's discoveries at Thombo turn our picture of prehistory inside out. The question isn't whether there were recurrent fires over a period of all those thousands of years. It's why.
Theremin said, I've seen plenty of explanations lately, all of them more or less fantastic. Someone from Kitro University was arguing that there are periodic rains of fire every few thousand years. And we got a letter at the newspaper from someone who claims to be a freelance astronomer and says he's proved that Calgash passes through one of the suns every so often. I think there were even wilder things proposed.
There's only one idea that makes any sense, Binet said quietly. Remember the concept of the Sword of Thargola? You have to dispense with a hypothesis that requires extra bells and whistles in order to make sense. There's no reason why a rain of fire should fall on us every now and then, and it's obvious nonsense to talk about passing through suns. But the eclipse theory is accounted for perfectly by mathematical consideration of the orbit of Calgash as it's affected by universal gravitation.
The eclipse theory may stand up, yes, no doubt it does. We'll find out pretty soon, eh? Theremin said. But apply Thargola's sword yourself to what you've just said. There's nothing in the eclipse theory that tells us that there'll necessarily be tremendous fires immediately afterward.
No, Sheeran said. There's nothing about that in the theory. But common sense indicates it. The eclipse will bring darkness. Darkness will bring madness. And madness will bring the flames, which wrecks another couple of millenniums of painful struggle. It all comes to nothing tomorrow. Tomorrow there won't be a city standing unharmed in all Calgash.
You sound just like the apostles, Theremin said angrily. I heard pretty much the same stuff from Philemon 66 months ago, and told you two about it, I recall, at the Six Suns Club.
He gazed out the window past the wooded slopes of Observatory Mount to where the spires of Sorrow City gleamed bloodily on the horizon. The newspaperman felt the tension of uncertainty grow within him as he cast a quick glance at Dovim. It glowered redly at Zenith, dwarfed and evil. Doggedly, Theremin went on.
I can't buy your chain of reasoning. Why should I go nuts just because there isn't a sun in the sky? And even if I do, yes, I haven't forgotten those poor bastards in the Tunnel of Mystery. Even if I do, and everyone else does, how does that harm the cities? Are we going to blow them down?
I said the same thing at first, Binet put in, before I stopped to think things through. If you were in darkness, What would you want more than anything else? What would it be that every instinct would call for?
Why, light, I suppose.
Yes, Sheeran cried, shouting now. Light, yes, light.
So?
And how would you get the light?
Theremin pointed to the switch on the wall.
I'd turn it on.
Right, said Sheeran mockingly. And all the gods in their infinite kindness would provide enough current to give you what you wanted. Because the power company certainly wouldn't be able to. Not with all the generators grinding to a halt, and the people who operate them stumbling around babbling in the dark, and the same with the transmission line controllers. You follow me?
Theremin nodded numbly.
Sheeran said, Where would the light come from when the generators stop? The godlights, I suppose. They've all got batteries. But you may not have a godlight handy. You'll be out there on the street in the darkness, and your godlight will be sitting at home, right next to your bed, and you want light. So you burn something, eh, Mr. Theremin? Ever see a forest fire? Ever go camping and cook a stew over a wood fire? Heat isn't the only thing burning wood gives off, you know. It gives off light, and people are very well aware of that. And when it's dark, they want light, and they're going to get it.
So they'll burn logs, Theremin said without much conviction.
They'll burn whatever they can get. They've got to have light. They've got to burn something, and wood won't be handy, not on city streets. So they'll burn whatever is nearest. A pile of newspapers? Why not? The Sorrow City Chronicle will give a little brightness for a while. What about the newsstands that the papers on sale are stacked up in? Burn them too. Burn clothing. Burn books. Burn roof shingles. Burn anything. The people will have their light, and every center of habitation goes up in flames. There are your fires, Mr. Newspaperman. There is the end of the world you used to live in.
If the eclipse comes, said Theremin, an undertone of stubbornness in his voice.
If, yes, said Sheeran. I'm no astronomer, and no apostle either, but my money's on the eclipse.
He looked straight at Theremin. Eyes held each other as though the whole matter were a personal affair of respective willpowers. And then Theremin broke away wordlessly. His breathing was harsh and ragged. He put his hands to his forehead and pressed hard. Then came a sudden hubbub from the adjoining room.
Binet said, I think I heard Emot's voice. He and Faro must have showed up finally. Let's go in and see what kept them.
Might as well, muttered Theremin. He drew a long breath and seemed to shake himself. The tension was broken for the moment. 24. The main room was in an uproar. Everyone clustered around Faro and Emot, who were trying to parry a burst of eager questions while they removed their outer garments. Aethor bustled through the crowd and faced the newcomers angrily.
Do you realize that it's practically E-hour? Where have you two been?
Faro 24 seated himself and rubbed his hands. His round, fleshy cheeks were red with the outdoor chill. He was smirking strangely, and he seemed curiously calm, almost as if he had been drugged.
I've never seen him like that before, Binet whispered to Sheeran. He's always been very obsequious, very much the humble junior astronomer, deferring to the great people around him, even to me, but now...
Shh! Listen, Sheeran said.
Faro said, Emot and I have just finished carrying through a little crazy experiment of our own. We've been trying to see if we couldn't construct an arrangement by which we could simulate the appearance of darkness and stars so as to get an advanced notion as to how it looked. There was a confused murmur from the listeners.
Stars? Theremin said. You know what stars are? How did you find out?
Smirking again, Faro said,
By reading the Book of Revelations. It seems pretty clear that stars are something very bright. Like suns, but smaller, that appear in the sky when Kalgash enters the Cave of Darkness.
Absurd, someone said. Impossible. The Book of Revelations? That's where they did their research. Can you imagine?
Quiet, Aethor said.
There was a sudden look of interest in his eyes, a touch of his old vigor.
Go on, Faro. What was this arrangement of yours? How did you go about it?
Well, said Faro, the idea came to Emot and me a couple of months ago, and we've been working it out in our spare time. Emot knew of a low one-story house down in the city with a domed roof, some kind of warehouse, I think. Anyway, we bought it.
With what?
Interrupted Aethor peremptorily.
Where did you get the money?
In our bank accounts, grunted the lanky, pipe-stem-limbed Emot 70. It cost us 2,000 credits. Then defensively,
Well, what of it? Tomorrow, 2,000 credits will be 2,000 pieces of paper and nothing else.
Sure, Faro said. So we bought the place and rigged it up with black velvet from top to bottom so as to get as perfect a darkness as possible.